for Leo Kottke.
Thank you.
Actually, maybe I'll just avoid this time. Well, no, what I was going to do was speak, but I never have anything to say at this point, and that's all I ever do mention is the fact that I don't have anything mentionable. And then, you know, contrary to whatever expectation that might, you know, cook up in anybody's mind, I go ahead and talk for a while. And I'm beginning to think, actually, since last night at least, that I might be mistaken. That maybe it's better if I just, you know, shut up for a while at least. Because it has happened to me more than once. I'd hesitate to tell you how many times that somebody will come up to me after a show and say, "Leo, I came to hear you play." So maybe I should do a little more of that than I have been doing. I'm going to predict something. There'll be at least one huge bug that will come straight at me from out here. This happens every time. There were bugs here the last time, but they're better tonight. At least so far, better behaved. Let's see. Let me play this. This is yeah, there's some high contrast. This was written by Carla Bley. It was recorded by Jimmy Giuffre with Steve Swallow, and this is an arrangement by Tim Sparks from Giuffre's recording of Carla Bley's song. I have not once in yet. No, I can't say that anymore. Last year, for the first time, I heard her version of her tune. So I'll be leaving the stage during this next song. I'll come back when it's done. What a wonderful place. Does anybody ever just leap into that cataract there? Excuse me, Robin. I shouldn't encourage that or anything, and I'm not. I don't know what kind of insurance he has here. There was a guy in a kayak here earlier when I drove up that I swear had training wheels on it or some version of the thing. Does anybody here knows about that? Are there such things? Is that right? They put like, that was you, okay. They work. You've survived. And someone else was going sideways down this. Maybe that's one of the techniques that I've never kayaked myself. See what I mean? My apologies. I do have to mention with this next tune that I tried to quit. As a matter of fact, I think the last time I played here, I had quit flying and I was driving every. And I'll start over again. Was that? Let me just. Okay. This is just the thing I should be doing, isn't it? After it's been acting up, it's just. Start strangling it, playing with it. I had quit flying and I was driving everywhere. I drove here, I drove where, I think I went to Salt Lake next from here. And, or maybe it was Moab, I don't remember. And I loved this and it fulfilled a dream that I had had, which was to, well, of course, to quit flying, but to play instead of all of these, what the agency calls primary and secondary markets, I wanted to play some tertiary markets as often as I could, wherever I could find them. And, you know, the places where Walmart has gone and continues to go. And, I figured if you can do that with shampoo and Stridex, you can certainly do it with a guitar. So I tried and it didn't work. What has happened is that phenomenon, that Walmart phenomenon, is a fact, and they're milk dry. The town is dead. It's no longer tertiary. It's dead. And I couldn't work there. I couldn't. Nothing happened along those lines. But on my way, I was driving now on my way to the primary and secondary markets. I drove through a lot of tertiary markets and got to, you know, absorb the ambiance that that bouquet of decay. It's odd because there are some towns like Pocatello, for example, that have this phenomenon happened, this Walmart franchise, whatever it is. Why am I getting into this stuff? But it happens. I'm trying to think what this reminds me of. It's sort of like it happens, the town dies, and then way out around the town, these things crop up. And that's what's left. And in Pocatello's case, it's almost as if, well, never mind. It was not a pleasant experience viewing these tertiary markets. It became a dream realized to my dismay rather than to my glee. And I was ready to give it up. As a matter of fact, I'm flying again. But on the in the middle of that, I found myself driving through past Oxford, Mississippi, one day, which I know as the burial place of William Faulkner. I mean, most other people may think of it as the place where he lived and wrote. But I'm a more contemporaneous kind of guy. He's dead now. That's what he's doing now. So that's where he's buried. And I had to go to Oxford, which is, if you've been there, it's a trip through the worst that kudzu has to offer. It's astounding. There's nothing there but shapes that are reminiscent of what was. There's a lot of weird stuff going on. And I got into town, and what I had read about the place was true. They didn't want to know about him, and frankly, I think didn't know about him. The fact that he had won a Nobel Prize held no, and that he'd written literature that actually started a whole school in South America, and that was itself, and blah blah blah. That didn't matter. What mattered was that he had many years ago been the postmaster of Oxford, Mississippi, and when people came in to mail their letters, he would steam the stamps off after they'd left and use them for his own purposes. That's something else we could talk about. And no one knew where he was buried. I asked around. I've wound up in the courthouse, the same one that appears in all his books, where there's always somebody up on the second floor looking out the window who's about to be hung. And I walked into the records office. Nobody knew where he was. They had heard of him. And literally, a woman who had heard me asking this stuff had left. And as I was giving up and preparing to plow back through the kudzu, she came back and whispered in my ear, "I know where he's buried." Took me out in the hall and told me how to find him. Well, you can imagine what a letdown it was when I finally got there to the grave. After all the expectations I'd built up, I got so little out of it that I was mad. I hold him accountable for this. I told T-Bone Burnett, you know, that I'd gone to the grave and it wasn't what it's cracked up to be. And he said, "Well, he's dead, you know." Which told me that T-Bone is not nearly as hip as I thought he was, or maybe as. Just didn't understand. Because if you've read his books, they're horrible. They're really not pleasant to read, and so you stop, and years later you go back because other writers that you enjoy have claimed to think he's. So what did you miss? So you go back, you read it again. It's the same drudgery, the same monotony, the same endless sentences, the same new English. I mean, he makes up words every paragraph or so. Defunctive is one of them. Rosa Caulfield sat in an augmenting and defunctive twilight. Would you sit in a twilight like that? Let alone write about it? I don't know. But I persevered, and by about the fifth book, which was probably Absalom, Absalom, which is an unbelievably, it's really hard to get through that book. I finally got through it. I got to the end. I was disgusted. I was bored. It hurt a little bit. And I thought, they're wrong. This guy is a turkey. He should have, you know, he was a postmaster, and he should have stayed there. An evil postmaster. But about 5 minutes later, and if you want to read him, I recommend it for this reason. He hits you all at once. The whole Absalom comes back at you, and it's just as monotonous. There's just as much drudgery in it, but this time you enjoy it. It has a halo around it or something. It's an uncanny experience. So I expected him to communicate from the grave, and he didn't. So I play this song. I mean... This is a tough job. This is artistry at work. Anyhow, you don't have to EQ it out. I don't have anything better to do. I don't know why I'm doing this. Faulkner is the guy who said that it's every man's fondest wish to outlive his wife. So I know that he would despise this next song. It would make him turn over in his grave, which is just what I was hoping for, and I hope he's listening. Because his wife outlived him by 20 years, and he's buried next to her. Ring, ring, telephone ring. Somebody says, baby, what you doing? About you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall, 'cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on in, baby, we'll laugh and sing, and we'll make love, let the telephone ring. Ring, ring, doorbell ring, come on in, I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around. I've been feeling down, talking to Tony and Mario. You know they make good conversation. Still, it ain't no consolation, 'cause I got love. Baby, I'll give you something, and if somebody comes, let the doorbell ring. Dark and windy street, in a room at the top of the stairs. She smokes cigarettes and stares at the wall, not knowing that my heart lives there. In the cool of the night, she takes me inside and helps soothe my troubles and pain. She's warm and she's sweet, her kisses leave me weak. I love it when she touches my face. About the past, the sorrow and regret. She cries about the gray in her hair. I love her so much, she just won't believe any man alive could ever care. I wish I'd been there when she was a girl before love had treated her unfair. She'd not be so sad, she'd not live alone in that room at the top of the stairs. In that room at the top of the stairs. Thank you. They said that Louise was not half bad. It was written on the walls and window shade. And though she'd act the little girl, but deceiver. Everybody knew at times she cried. Oh, but women like Louise, they get by. Everybody thought it kind of sad when they found Louise in a room. They'd always put her down below their kind. Still some is blowing cold tonight. So good night, Louise. Good night. I'd like to play a song that I heard first sometime in high school. It's been recorded three or four times by its author, Pete Seeger, and it's called Living in the Country. He claims, as he does with practically everything he's written, that he didn't write it. This tune, more than anything else he's done, except maybe a version of Coal Creek March on the banjo, is loaded with this instrumental stuff that he can do that I have never heard anyone else doing, except maybe Joseph Spence, and that's a whole other, and that's not Pete Seeger, you know, it's Joseph Spence. And I was right when I started tonight. What else can I tell us that we already know? There's some kind of backwards thing that he does, and I've never figured it out, except that it involves pushes and dropped beats, and for me it's turned out to be replacing the thumb with the index finger at those moments where you'd least expect it. And it winds up being, it really is neat, and he does it. And then that's what Spence does as well, but I think he replaces the thumb with another thumb. He has a thing that he does that I can't. as it happens with everybody, I've tried to figure out what he does. I couldn't. What I figured out as a version of it, I decided was me, and went on to make a career out of it. The stuff, in other words, he's the person I'm most aware of having stolen things from, and there are people and entire tunes that I've stolen that I'm sure I haven't discovered yet. I, at one time, thought I had written Cripple Creek. I was going around playing it and calling it Turtle Hills, thinking I'd really come up with something. And no one ever came up to me and said, you know, what a jerk. Haven't you... So I'd like to play this now. Not too long ago, I decided that I ought to try and get a hold of him and say hello and just tell him how much this all meant to me. And I wrote him a letter, and he mailed me back a leaf. There's nothing on the leaf, you know, not like, you know, other side, turned leaf, nothing. I'm speechless. I still am every time I think of it. And I've met him about 3 or 4 years after that in New York. He's playing a benefit for some country now long gone. And trying to, you know. And I went up, I knew the promoter, and went up to him afterwards, and I said, Pete, hi. And he looked away. He doesn't look at you. Most of the people, when he talks to people, he looks up here at a horizon that's constantly approaching. He's about 8 feet tall, and he keeps his eye out there. And every now and then, just when you think you ought to just disappear into the dirt, he'll look down and hit you with this ray. It's a disjunctive experience. Not defunctive, but it is just. I was trying to say something to him, and finally all I could think of was to ask him for his phone number. And he drew me a map to his house instead and asked me if I'd come out and play the Strawberry Shortcake Festival that they have there every week, because Dairy Queen had destroyed the goodness that had once existed in Strawberry Shortcake. It was perfect, you know. I blushed a little bit, and I couldn't believe it. And a woman approached him. She had a strong Spanish accent and said, Pete, I'm getting married. He said, wonderful. I don't think they'd ever met. There's countless people coming, like me, coming up to him. He said, the most beautiful love song in any language is, and he rattled off some long title, and then he grabbed her by the shoulders, looked off at the horizon, and sang her the whole song. This song had about 40 verses to it. It was like 99 bottles of beer on the wall. She couldn't move. She couldn't fade into the dirt. She couldn't sneak away. And she had to pay attention because every now and then he'd look down and hit her with this ray, and she'd try and crank up her thank you smile a little bit longer. Ruined her. Ruined her. But it was, I couldn't have hoped for anything better, you know. I couldn't. This is the guy who told, I remember reading this article and seeing an illustration, as if you needed one for this, of his advice to those people who were too poor to buy an instrument. His advice was, you could still make music. And here's where there's a fatal flaw in his reasoning. First of all, what he suggests is that you get a piece of baling wire. That's flaw enough. I don't even know what piece of baling wire and two empty spools of thread. You nail the baling wire to your wall, and there's this flaw. You probably don't have a wall if you're that poor that you can't buy a ukulele or a kazoo or something. You nail the wire to the wall, you put the spool under each end, and then you pluck the wire and you move one spool up and down, thereby turning your wall into a musical instrument. He gave this as a name, as if it needed a name, and the name was Wall Zither. So I would love it. You know, someday somebody's going to see a wall somewhere with a wall zither nailed to it, and they won't be able to figure it out. He played a 12-string that was made by a guy in Britain. It was the first 12-string I heard that wasn't Lead Bellies or Barbecue Bobs, and that wasn't playing only some form of blues. And it was a beautiful instrument with a kind of inverted triangle thing here. Well, I don't know. It was a triangle. What's the bottom of a triangle? I don't know. The guy died, and then Pete drove over his in his station wagon. And so this guitar, which had a 28-inch scale and strings the size of bridge cables as big as your ankle, was doomed to disappear. It was a great instrument. And a guy who teaches, I forget now what he teaches, but let's say economics, decided he would take up the tradition and continue to build this guitar. What an amazing presumption that is. And he did, and they work. And I saw one when I was playing in Massachusetts. The opening act had one. I'd never seen one. I said, this is one of Pete's guitars. He said, well, the builder is here. Think, go away. Builder is here today. He'll be here tonight. I met the builder after the show, and I said, gee, that's great. What a wonderful instrument. I thought I'd never see one of these things. And I said, by the way, I mailed Pete Seeger a letter once, and he mailed me back a leaf. And he said, oh, yeah, I have lots of leaves. So this is Pete Seeger's song, Living in the Country, which he claims to have stolen from some Bahamians. Thank you. Say what? What is wrong? I can't hear up here. I always try, but I blew it all out in the Navy. I really did. This is one of my favorite pieces called Oddball. A guy in Washburn, I think his name is, was interviewing Chet Atkins for the LA Times a few months ago, talking about this tune. And Chet said, Leo's got some strange things going on in that head of his. It was almost as good as being asked to play the Strawberry Shortcake Festival. I missed it. They aren't as dumb as they look, are they? What a life. That's, we got into that last time, didn't we?
Among those afraid of losing their ground.
Play something. Let me play something you haven't heard yet. This is the I like to I'll try to cover some of those. I like to squeeze some of these new ones in as well. This is a ballad that stiffs every time I do it, and so it's a kind of a perverse thrill for me to perform it. It's called A World Made to Order. This is on my label has asked me to mention these things, the number mainly that I have records for sale. And I've said to the label time and again, but how can they find them? And they say, this one is, I'm finishing now, is I'm doing with Ricky Lee Jones, and it'll be out in probably 10, 12 years. And I'm working, at any rate, this is one of the tunes on there. Ricky's record is coming out in September. It's a wonderful record. I'm playing on that. But this was... I had somebody in mind when I wrote this. I rarely do that, but this guy was an engine man. When I was in the Navy, he was on the Halfbeak, which was the submarine that I was on for I don't even remember now, probably no more than a month. He was in the Navy for, at that point, had been in for about 22 years. I'd been in for 6-7 months. And his nickname and the name that everybody called him, knew him by, and you could call him this instead of Chief, was Evil. He had a face that was horrible. It looked, there were rocks younger than this face. And it had a cast to it that was chilling. and you had to frequently go through the engine room to get back to wherever you're going in the back of this tube, and Evil would be in there without his ear protectors on, glowering out between the diesels in this unbelievable racket that they make, and he'd scare you to death. But we found out once why he looked that way. He claimed to have been a drinker of torpedo fuel. He said that this was something that had been part of his past, and he didn't do it anymore. But this fuel still existed at that time. I mean, it didn't drive the torpedo. It drove a little generator that charged a battery that then ran the torpedo, which went then generally ran straight out, turned around, came straight back at you. That really is how they worked for many years. So this is a stunning achievement. So maybe that's why they never complained too much when Evil would drink this fuel. It even has a name. I mean, it has a name as a cocktail. I didn't know this until recently. It was called a Pink Lady, because the fuel is what a romantic name for an engineman 300 feet down drinking kerosene or whatever it was. It was pink. And the trick was, the deal was, you'd get a loaf of French bread and you'd cut off the end of the French, both ends of the French bread. I do that every time I talk about this, as if it's an Einsteinian sort of loaf. It just goes on forever and only has one end. At first place, I can't imagine this guy Evil, who was all of 450 years old, bringing a baguette onto his submarine. But you cut the ends off this loaf, and you pour your fuel into the bread, and you catch what runs out the other end of the bread, and you keep doing that until the fuel is clear, and then it's safe to drink. You won't go blind, crazy, or die. You won't have convulsions in there amongst the... What we knew from looking at Evil was that after he had his drink ready, he drank that and then ate the bread anyhow. And the scene I'd like to paint for you before I play this, you may have guessed this is a ballad already. The scene I want you to keep in mind is what happened one night between Evil and a guy named Denson. And by the way, why did they keep Evil for 25 years and throw me out after 7 months? I never could figure that out. I never drank. They did this thing where they turn out all the lights in the boat. They'd sit stationary at crush depth. That's a nice, crush depth. This was the second oldest submarine in the United States Navy that was sitting at crush depth with Evil in charge of the engines on the thing. And they do this thing where they turn off the air circulators, they turn out all the lights, and they turn on these red things. They tell you to take off your shoes and get rid of rings or jewelry or anything, and don't talk. If you have to speak, and you shouldn't speak, speak in a whisper. You know, the danger was that everybody would break out laughing at any minute, because there were tuna boats up there listening for you. And this would go on for many, many hours. People like Evil wandering around in a red light, not saying anything, making no noise. And we were supposed to eat. And we sat down at these tables covered with rubber, and we were waiting to eat. And we'd been down, and you can imagine, first of all, just what it smells like. It's an amazing, even though, well, never mind, don't imagine that. We're sitting there, and Denson started to clean his thumbnail with a fork, his own fork, and Evil exploded. He screamed, jumped across this rubber table mat, grabbed Denson's fork, and stabbed him in the neck with it. It was beautiful. It was after 12 hours of red silence, it was just what we all needed. But Evil had made a noise, so the tuna boats were now aware of our presence. Evil got in big trouble. The fork hung there for just a second. I don't want you to... and then fell. I don't want you to think that, you know, he was maimed. So this is called A World Made Order. If I was Axl Rose, I'd have jumped right on top of it. I'm going to engineer my approach to the end of this with a couple tunes here and a couple tunes there. This is another one of those tunes that just has always meant an awful lot to me, and it took me a long time to find a way to play this thing. It was written by Duane Allman, so I love Martha. Thank you. Peppy Hush is, I've tried to do it, and it really sounds pathetic without Margot's singing on it. It just goes to lunch, what I'm going to do as soon as I, because it's been a while now since I've done it, what I'm going to do is learn it, and then bring people up to sing harmony. That ought to be horrible. Boy, oh boy. But it might work on a song like that. Just how beautiful she was. Everything it takes to get a guy like me in love. Lord, I hope she's happy, 'cause she sure deserves to be, especially for what she did for me. Yes, I owe it all to Pamela Brown. All of my good times, all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town, and I guess I owe it all to Pamela Brown. Yes, I owe it all to Pamela Brown. thank you very much for coming out here tonight. And I hope I'm here next year. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot. can't for the life of me remember. Yeah, I haven't done that, have I?
Ouch.
Let me play this. This was a hit for the Sutherland Brothers and Quiver. Two bands were at one time the Sutherland Brothers or Quiver, who played in Britain. I think they did a. Oh, why did I do? I always like to mention what's Frank Zappa. Yeah. Said after, when somebody asked him why he named his daughter Moon Unit, he said, "What should I call her? Mary?" Only he says it better than I can. Thank you.